All right, hello again, everybody. This is Cambridge Inside Out, and I'm Robert Winters. And over there on the other corner,
I am Counselor Mark McGovern.
No, he is not.
What?
This is Mr. Patrick Barrett. Anyway, we were just the last half hour, we were speaking a little bit about some Central Square stuff. So probably an appropriate time just to get a little bit of a status report update on something you are personally involved in, namely proposals for re-envisioning and remaking, reinventing the site where the Middle East is currently.
So you're talking about my plan to convert the current Middle East site into a missile silo to protect us from Somerville and in Belmont.
I thought it was actually a hazardous waste dump that you had proposed.
Well, it's really a toss up. So we had our historical commission, first round with historical.
Oh, so just so everybody knows what we're talking about here.
Oh, so yes, right? I'm converting the Middle East into the Middle East, plus a hotel and a bar on the rooftop.
All right.
We are in the process.
And I'm very disappointed that you are not going to be bringing back the bowling alley in the basement that was once there. I'll forgive you.
We brought all these great historical photos, and I wish I had them with me right now, but the bowling alley and the Guns and Loan. Like, what a time.
Where was the Guns and Loan again? You told me, but I forgot.
The Guns and Loan is where Zuzu is currently now.
Okay, so it was Guns and Loans.
Guns and Loans. So like you go, I'm not sure like what the order of that is. Maybe you get a loan to buy a gun, or maybe you get
buy the gun and then you say, give me that loan.
Well, it's like a junior capitalist starter kit. Like, I need a gun, I need some money, and here you go. Get out into the world.
For those who feel Cambridge has been frozen in amber and unchanging over the decades, just be aware that where the Middle East operates used to be a Guns and Loan.
The amber has cracked a bit, but I actually love the idea of a bowling alley in Central Square. That would just kill. But what I'm doing is I'm going to rebuild the Middle East bigger and badder than ever it was before. Upstairs, downstairs. There's discussion about possibly a third music venue, which I'm not sure we're going to be able to do, but we're going to try. And then we have a 140-room hotel above that with a restaurant bar similar to what you see over at 907 Main, with currently, you can't see my cell phone, 100% occupancy right now. I get nightly reports just about this time, and we're back to 100%. After a small dip yesterday to 95%, we have a rooftop bar called the Blue Owl, which is sort of a sister property to how we're envisioning this new place. We went to historical. I went to historical. Gave what I would.
And this is because, as one part of the process, one has to demolish an existing structure.
So it takes me back to this linkage conversation we just had. I'll be brief about it, but like, if I put stilts on the building and built a new building above the existing building, no linkage. You follow? Yeah. So like, if I preserve a building that has been stripped away of all its architectural elements, that actually has been half raised as the Middle East current building has, it makes no sense to preserve such a thing. So we're going to demo it. Because in order to rebuild the Middle East as I think we want to see it, right now the ceiling heights are like 10 feet. We want to go down, get a nice 16 foot clear. We want to be able to put ventilation systems in that are sort of, how shall I put this, COVID friendlier, egresses, handicap accessibility. It doesn't make sense to keep the old structure. And plus we're trying to compensate for the 2070 floodplains maps that we're looking at. Climate change is an issue. So having to change the elevations of the building, to me, all require new build. I think the Historical Commission largely agreed with me. My presentation was light, and that was intentional, but also well observed by the Historical Commission. I am a firm believer in these kinds of open processes. I wanted to have this meeting with Charlie even before we discussed the historical nature of the building. Removing the Middle East is an important thing. And when I say removing, I mean knocking the building down and rebuilding it. But I want to be able to explain to people what we're doing so they're not terrified. I mean, there's always going to be people who don't like something. And I've I've heard you. But you know, what my team is going to do is we're going to rebuild the Middle East, upstairs and downstairs, make them accessible for everybody, make them safer, bigger, badder, and build what Cambridge needs, more hotel. And we're gonna meet that demand.
I'll sort of add in here that in a place like Central Square, which is supposed to be sort of part, one of our principal cultural centers for Cambridge, to not only preserve but actually enhance venues like this is a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, so well, and a typical developer, you know, evil or otherwise, wouldn't necessarily be looking at it from the same perspective as you are. So I think,
well, I'm the evilest, nastiest, meanest, baddest developer that ever was. So like, obviously I am doing this only for money, because I'm just an evil guy. But you know, I played at the Middle East as a musician. I met my wife at TG the Bears. My family has a lot of history in this building. My family is starting to have a lot of history in Cambridge. We're newbies here. We've only been here for 15 years, but this is our home. This is something we want to cultivate and care about. We moved to Central Square specifically. And you know, we've made a commitment, and this is part of that commitment. I'm looking forward to working with the Sater family. I'm looking forward to building this thing, and it's going to be great. But you know, for 2 years, the Middle East will be down, and we're thinking about how to fill that gap as well. But the club will run through next year, and then we'll be shovels in the ground sometime in 24, depending on planning board approval. And then there's plenty of people out there who might want to try to stop that. And to them, I say, you know, have at it.
Yeah. So anyway, so it's interesting. And it kind of looks like maybe, I mean, there's still some regulatory hurdles to get through, you know, appropriate boards to say yay.
I like the historical commission's approach. They're more collaborative, and I invited them to help me build this place. I invited the CDD to do the same. You know, I don't want it to, I think Mass and Main across the street is one of the ugliest buildings in Central Square, next to possibly the one in 10 Essex. Sorry, Morris, it's just ugly. But I think we can build something beautiful here. I think we can make a new icon for the square. You know, if people really want the guns and loans back, we can talk about that. But I do think what we're doing is making sure that music stays in the Central Square for at least another half century. That's important.
Yeah, it's actually, somebody should write the book about the history of music venues in Central Square. I remember the Rise Club, when you used to come up Brookline Street, it was up on the top floor. It was like a big nightclub, you know, with disco balls and everything. And you could hear it blaring out over Central Square. There used to be a really great blues club over on Norfolk Street. It's just a parking lot now, but this is a really nice history. And
it's easy to lose music venues to other things. And again, like, you know, the affordable housing people, I love you to death, but like, God damn, like we need other things besides just affordable housing. We do. Right.
Yeah. And so in the heart of Central Square, you know, we're, you know, teeming with people. I mean, I think this could be a very, very good thing. So anyway, we'll
making progress.
We'll keep an eye on it as time passes here. Now, another thing that's been happening, you know, something that's some, I guess, significant interest to me, is that, you know, we do have a charter review committee, mm-hmm. that is continuing. The last meeting was canceled for various reasons. And they have another one coming up, I believe, next Tuesday. Right. So that's the official group, is 15 people appointed. You know, there are some issues about how that all came to be, but it's proceeding. A little bit of some oddities about it, quite honestly, in the fact that even though city councilors were prohibited, any elected official was prohibited from being on the charter review committee, nonetheless, city council aides are kind of, you know, keeping their thumbs on the scales of this thing and sort of being somewhat administratively responsible for parts of it, which I don't think is exactly right, but it is proceeding, you know. But a curiosity happened. I just happened to be, while they were blowing insulation into my walls on Monday or Tuesday, I decided to take a little walk around the block, and I just dropped by the election commission, you know, because it was something I was going to ask about them, completely independent of any of this. And then he said to me, he says, Are you involved in trying to form an independent charter commission? And I said, what? No, that's not me. Because apparently, you know, there's some organized crew, I don't actually even know for sure who it is. I have some suspicions, are independent of the
city. I know who.
Well, I think I kind of know who. But they basically want to say, well, we don't like what they're doing, so we're going to try and do it on their own. Now, it's a bit of a heavy lift. You can't just sort of form a charter commission. You have to gather a lot of signatures. I forget what the requirements are. And then you have to, it's a longer process than just a charter review.
I can't think of any counselor aide who just loves gathering signatures and being a general pain in the ass. Who could have, like, it's going to be a real head scratcher for me to figure out who the hell wants to do that.
Let's just say that right near the Throgsnick Bridge in New York, there's a fort with this man's name on it. And I will leave that cryptic thing for those of you who want to go to Google Earth right now.
But that brings me to like a larger point about like the collegiality, dude. Who's running the show right now? And I think that's, everyone's just kind of freaking out a little bit, but like when you have counselors who are willing to, I think unethically, put their people on, you know, not people on commissions, but to send them out into the world and say, you know, I don't like how this process is going here with my team. You go get some signatures and we'll figure out how to circumvent my eight other colleagues. And then what I can't figure out on top of that is, if you're one of those eight other colleagues, why on God's green earth would you ever talk to that guy ever again?
Right.
You put him in a corner, you put the stupid hat on him, and you say, we're done. See you in 2 years.
Well, you know, there is a sort of kind of an awkward thing about, you know, the current city charter, the Plan E charter from right here, from the get-go, basically says that I, you know, Patrick or I, either of us could go talk to city staff. We could ring up a department. We could rip them a new one. We can do that. But elected officials, elected city councils actually cannot do this. It's actually felonious for them to do it. They must act through the city manager. But one of the more awkward developments that happened really 20 years ago now was when they started having city council aides. They used city council aides as proxies, basically to do some of that dirty work and say, councilor says, my hands are clean, I didn't do anything. But I know a former city councilor who actually had some people going into some city department saying, well, I'm here representing councilor so-and-so, and I just want to let you know. And I was like, wait a minute.
Some council aides present themselves as councilors or as authorities for the city.
Right.
While you were talking, Robert, I had an idea pop into my head. Why don't we introduce the idea that in this charter review that we make city councilor aides subject to the same rules and limitations that city councilors are?
Actually, I think that's a fabulous idea. And I would actually categorize it as more of a clarification of the existing rule. Ooh. In other words, if the charter, which did not envision having, you know, the staff basically acting as proxies, put a prohibition on councilors, then basically anyone who's working on behalf of the counselor should be subject to the same restrictions.
Yeah.
Right.
I 100% agree. And that's how I would interpret it today, like you're saying, but for the fact that it doesn't say assigns or specifically enumerate a city council aide. But, you know, this is something that probably should have been addressed at the time the aides were introduced. But, you know, right now you've got a city council that I think with a new city manager, that there's going to be a little bit of a power push. We're seeing that right now. But what I'm seeing really is like, I see a lot of counselors who are doing their jobs. And I see one or two counselors who are really trying to break the system. And I think they need to be held accountable. But moreover, if they can't be held accountable or their colleagues are unwilling to do that, let's use this moment of charter review to rein them back in.
You know, I have some points of view about all this. I would say them all here right now, but, you know, I wish the Charter Review Commission, the committee, the best in actually coming up, and hopefully they'll grow into the role and come up with good ideas and also show appropriate restraint. I mean, your job is to review the charter. It's not to overthrow the government necessarily, right? You know, and just because, you know, you got picked in some questionable process in order to do this role here, that doesn't mean you're the revolutionary designees, you know. There are some things that should be fixed, to be sure. I mean, I, like we were just talking about, said clarification about employees working for city councilors being subject to the same rules as city councilors, for example. I don't know that the current city councilors would be particularly receptive to, for example, getting rid of the election system as it stands right now that allows them to be elected with 10% of the vote. You know, to win your quota of votes under a proportional representation system. If you started going to district councilors, it's not so clear to me how many of the current city councilors would even be elected in their own districts under that change of rule. So, you know, self-preservation of your own job here, right, is still a factor. So I don't know that I expect them to kind of revolutionize that. I also know that don't think that they necessarily want to overthrow the notion about having a city manager form of government.
You know, I think if they want to hold their jobs, or they, I mean, the people who are the loudest voices in the room about, oh, we need a revision of the Flaney Charter. I think they don't realize how much democracy they're currently enjoying under the current system, that with a strong mayor, a lot of those doors would be shut to them. They wouldn't have, as I lovingly refer to them, 9 ding-dongs they could refer to go back to ask this, that, and the other thing from. But I do think, like, you know, Patty Nolan is one who I think brought this process to bear. I don't think it was a bad idea, but I do think trying to temper expectations is probably a good idea in terms of saying, like, well, this is what we hope to get out of it, and making some slight revisions to it to address modern conditions. I'm a little bit worried. I mean, I was very much worried when the city council now has a right of appointment over BZA and planning board members.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to that. That's actually a topic maybe we should mention right now. So right now the city manager has put out the call for applicants for a good long while, they were doing no board appointments. I think they were kind of waiting for the new regime here to settle in. So now the city manager has called for new applicants for the Board of Zoning Appeals. And now we're really going to kind of see whether in fact this notion about city council review of board appointments, what this really shakes out to be.
And because I'm not afraid of anything, especially rejection, I have also thrown my hat in the ring for the BZA.
You'd be good at it, actually. You have a lot of very specific knowledge about it. But, you know, there's a situation there where I've always been concerned, like even before this went on the ballot last year, that you would have a situation where the only people who could then ever be nominated by the city manager were people who would be not just approved by the current city councilors, but by the people behind the scenes who are sort of political affiliates of city councilors. So if you have endorsing organizations like a Better Cambridge, or the Cambridge Citizens Coalition, whatever. If you felt you had a majority, would you then feel that you should be able to vet all nominees prior to their?
I guarantee you that they should. And my guess is when you start seeing flyers and emailers like we do for issues now, where, you know, please speak tomorrow night to endorse candidate X for the BZA. He's the right guy because he believes that all housing should be affordable and blah 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 blah.
Well, you know, one other aspect that came out of a government operations committee meeting earlier this year, which I found strange, to say the least, was the discussion went more or less like this. It says, we wouldn't want to embarrass somebody by having them be nominated to, let's say, the Board of Zoning Appeal, and only to be rejected by the city council in a very public vote, right? Or wouldn't that be just dreadful? So, Mr. City Manager, couldn't we just quietly behind the scenes basically talk about who we would find acceptable before you even get a chance to nominate them? And I thought to myself, well, in this era of things like open meeting laws and whatever, in other words, basically the appointing authority is basically going to have to work it out privately with a majority of city councilors before he even puts a name out there in the public. That's bizarre to me.
It is.
I mean, I wouldn't want to be appointed to a board and then get rejected. I mean, somehow I suspect it'll happen one day, but it.
You and I don't get put on boards anymore.
I mean, I've served on quite a few boards, and I think I have served honorably and professionally, and I have always tried to represent many more people than just myself. went on, whether it was Recycling Advisory Committee or the Technical Working Committee for Computerization of the Elections or Central Square Advisory Committee. I'm not just there to, from, you know, to advocate for myself. You know, I take the job very serious. I always have, you know, and I think most people who serve on boards and commissions do take their job very, very seriously.
That's true.
So I've never really warmed up to the notion that somehow anybody would have to be vetted by political groups. It'd be one thing if city councils were just using their own good judgment to see who's a good qualified candidate, but yeah.
Okay, hotshot. Planning Board appointee Winters, you have a parking minimum petition in front of you. Yay or nay? What's the right answer?
I would give a very nuanced answer. Because
I'm
a nuanced kind of guy, you know. I mean, you know, listen, in places like Central Square, where you know we are dedicated to Central Square, I don't really see the need or even the value in requiring parking for most anything. And you know, transit oriented development being what it is, I think that's almost like standard knowledge now. Is you wouldn't want to really insist upon that in places like that. But there are other places where there really is a real crunch, and you know, you can't just wish away automobiles. I mean, some people have legitimate reasons for wanting to do that. They may have to actually drive to work.
I got kids.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so the thing is, you can't just wish it all away based on whatever your criteria is. So, whatever degree it makes sense to reduce or eliminate parking minimums in places, I'd say go ahead.
I have to tell you, Robert, I'm completely turned off by your answer. I didn't hear any use of the word emergency. I didn't hear any use of the word crisis.
You're right. I didn't express the appropriate ideology.
We live in a post-fact age, my friend. We're either going to use the proper talking points or you're off the team.
Right. I'll throw in another aspect too, which is that, you know, we elect our elected officials based on proportional representations, but under the current council review, a slim majority of 5 could determine 100% of board appointments to any board. You know, you got to get past us 5 or else. That's it.
Know, I think it's asking a lot of volunteers to go through that kind of a process. I also think that, like, given some of the appointees we've had at the planning board, it's a tougher job than it looks. And I think, you know, there's some people who brought some nuance to it. There's some people who are just kind of a pain in the butt in general. But like, as a person who goes before the planning board, I've always viewed it as my job to convince these people that I'm right, aside from ideology. And I believe that I can crack any nut, just as any other attorney does. So I just think that the notion that the planning board is anachronistic or that the people on it currently serving are not the right people for the job is unfair to those people. The parking minimums aside, and like, I agree with your answer, Robert. It does require nuance. I think actually ultimately that's what this petition will allow for. But I think the way we're doing it right now is it's a little bit unusual to me. I mean, I've been watching your people for the past 15 years. To me, this is unimaginable 12 years ago, 5 years ago, unimaginable. In Central Square, when we brought the restoration petition, we got it down to 0.75. And that was almost a bridge too far. You know, so I think we've come a long way. I'm grateful for that. But I'm a little bit concerned about how we continually phrase these arguments in the terms of emergency or crisis.
Well, perhaps it's a national trend, but there's almost a religious quality to the way politics is being played now. You know, we have all decided that density, we must have absolute high density or under all circumstances, end of story, or we must obliterate all parking minimums under all circumstances, end of story, or pretty soon maybe it'll be we must ban cars and there's no discussion required or something like that. But
ordinance be with you, Robert. Ordinance be with you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am a man of great nuance. You know, I try to see things from lots of different sides. By the way, speaking of automobiles and trucking, there is a kind of a curiosity that I think is worth mentioning. It was actually the very last communication amongst the 81 communications at the city council meeting actually spoke to this, which was a letter from Joan Pickett saying, well, whatever happened to this petition of 97 people who were basically raising issues with some of the changes in traffic and parking regulations along Brattle Street? I believe there's actually another petition coming having to do with Garden Street, but the petition is addressed to the Traffic Board. Now, the Traffic Board was created under a special act of the Massachusetts State Legislature at the behest of people of Cambridge. When things were sort of chaotic in dealing with traffic-related issues in Cambridge generally, and it actually is what empowered a traffic director, such as outgoing traffic director Joe Barr, to have the authority to simply promulgate regulations without asking anybody, right? All you had to do was say, I have decided, this is it, and put it in the paper, and that was the end of it. Mm-hmm. Except the state legislature would never create a czar, right, without an appeals process. So they created something called the Cambridge Traffic Board, which is a three-person board. Then I think it was something like 50 people signed a petition as to...
Who's on the board currently?
Well, there's the funny part. So the board was allowed to just disappear. And I thought, well, it was somehow the vote was taken, disappeared. Turns out no vote was ever taken. The traffic court never disappeared. It just, the traffic department just basically chose to make it vanish. And now now some people are actually challenging this and saying, well, you know, and by the way, the in Massachusetts is a holdover state, which means if you were appointed and your term has expired, you are still on the board until such time as your replacement is named.
So do we know that means the people who are on the board in 92,
there are three of them are still living in Cambridge, and there are three member board. They're all here. So that's a very interesting dilemma for city management.
Do we give them a phone call and say, excuse me, you're being brought
back? I think it's interesting. And by the way, and if they just decide to vote to eliminate the traffic board, then they're also simultaneously eliminate the authority of the traffic director.
Whoa.
Yeah. So this is very interesting. But
laws are difficult to understand, Robert.
That's right. But on that note, we got to run. So we'll see you again soon on Cambridge Inside Out.